I went through the link after our first phone call, and
Yes.
before we get to the details, for the benefit of the audience that I'm presenting this to, can you tell me how you originally got involved with helping out the Overdose Prevention Society?
Yes, I've lived in this neighborhood since 1993, and I helped start a drug users organization in, well, pretty much in 95 onward. And then I left that position just to mostly out of exhaustion. And then I was working on a street project. I mean, a street market project. So we created a market because the police were giving people tickets for selling things on the sidewalk. So as a protest, we started to make a street market. And eventually, we kept working to get funding from the city, and we did get funding. And we had an empty lot, and we're a block from Main and Hastings, and it's a real epicenter for overdoses. There's estimated to be 5,000 people addicted to drugs in a sort of 10-block area of Vancouver. And when you work at the street market, you arrive at 8:30 in the morning and leave sort of 5 o'clock-ish. And all day long, we would hear people yelling, "Overdose! Does anyone have any Narcan?" And we would try to have Narcan because everyone in the neighborhood sort of does, and everyone knew the overdoses were a problem. And it was exhausting. So one of the members of our organization, her son died, and was very tied to us in the sense that she ran up the street and he couldn't be revived. And then they had him on life support, and she went to the hospital for a few days, and then he died. You know, it was very dramatic. And so the people in the project, I had been suggesting for a long time that we should make a little area of the market, just saying, if you're going to do drugs, can you just do them in this one area? And it saves us the bother of kind of running around trying to find equipment to revive somebody. And it also keeps other people from getting mad. Oh, there's a guy using drugs next to me. You should kick him out, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, they thought when the suggestion came up again, they all said, yes, let's do it, let's do it. And so we did it. And it was just a tent and table, because that's what these street markets are full of anyways, tents and tables. So that's how we got going with this project in the alley. And it was September of 2016 that we opened the tent and table.
Okay, so let's move on to the topic of fentanyl. Now, I think with respect to what we see in the mainstream media right now, there from the government side, there happens to be a lot of like grandstanding. Like for example, with the city of Vancouver, they are increasing like the rates of the property taxes partially to fund some sporadic treatment programs. The federal government gave exemptions to Insight, and now with the fentanyl crisis, the overdose crisis, I think they also gave like an exemption to Overdose Prevention Society as well. However, it still looks pretty piecemeal, as it doesn't look like they have a lot of action going on with inspecting mail for fentanyl. And there's also the situation with the National Health Emergency, with these overdose happening all over the country. Now, with the provincial government, now that we're about to have an election here right now, right? So the BC Liberal, the government, they have a lot of like reports and press, like news releases and news conferences to sh it looks like they're showing that they're at least doing something, while the opposition, the NDP, it looks like they just criticizes on the lack of legal treatment options and the overall problems with the healthcare system right now in terms of the strategy. So first question is, do you think there is a crisis, or has this been pretty constant and worsening gradually?
Well, in 1993, we had a crisis. And if you look at the per capita overdoses, and again in 97, but those were two spike years. Last year was the first year that they reached that level again. So we have already been through this. And Insight opened as a result of our work, you know, doing civil disobedience and opening illegal sites and stuff in the 90s. And then people were very complacent. And so I've always been on, you know, this is just me saying, I've always been super frustrated that we weren't pressuring to get more than one injection site during the years where we didn't have such huge numbers of overdose. We still had way too many. It was never considered okay, the number of people dying. And, you know, the analysis is if it was any other population, something would have been done. So nothing was done. And then because fentanyl comes in, we're seeing another crisis. And there's nothing really been done in the meantime. I just want to correct something you said, that Overdose Prevention Society in our tent, and now a trailer and tent, is not given any permit at all from the federal government. But they've applied to open a number of places, and they had applied in the fall. So when those applications are approved, which is an exemption from the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, they think they are envisioning a medical model, and we don't have a medical model. We have a community model. So the people working at our tent are just volunteers who know how to save people's lives. And we also allow people who use the site to also become volunteers. I don't really mind their business. They use whatever they use. What I do mind their business is I want them to do their, you know, volunteer duties perfectly during the 4 hours they're on duty, and, you know, not let anyone die, that kind of thing. You know, they have to maintain a standard. So we don't get into whether you're a user or not so much, but we know that a lot of the people that work there are users. And they come actually with quite a bit of extra knowledge that non-users wouldn't have. So it's been really helpful. In terms of the question you asked me, which was...
is there a crisis?
Yeah, there is a crisis, and it's going to be national. And it's because you can't stop this fentanyl. And the only way you can stop fentanyl being the attractive drug to people is that you give them something else. And there's been tremendous agreement amongst the BC bureaucrats, whether it's the Dr. Patty Daly, who's the medical health officer for Vancouver Coastal Health, or Perry Kendall, who's the provincial medical health officer, and then basically throughout the entire province, I don't think there's been any disagreement, that the only way to get people to not use this super dangerous drug is to get them something that has a that people know the contents of and know how to use it safely.
Essentially, they're talking about a safer substitute that they could monitor, right?
Yeah, so one of the problems is, you know, when I first started doing this work in the 90s, methadone, there were like 2,000 people on methadone in British Columbia. There's more than 20,000 people on methadone now in the province. And, you know, the province has vastly increased the number of people. So I don't know the per capita numbers, but there was a huge increase in the number. Like, that was one of the answers. Because not only did we have an overdose epidemic in the 90s, but this massive outbreak of HIV amongst people who used drugs, because they were sticking the numbers of needles that they were giving out. So we don't have an epidemic of AIDS going on anymore. And some things are kind of handled and move forward in that sense. But, you know, there's just tremendous public drug use here, because homelessness has doubled and then doubled and then doubled. And so people aren't using drugs inside, they're using drugs outside. And in some ways, ironically, that's saving their lives. So we know that 85% of the people who die of a drug overdose are inside in a room. And it might be a nice apartment, and it might be a really crappy single-room occupancy hotel slum, you know. But nonetheless, they are alone when they die, and they're inside. If you overdose outside now, because of the efforts of our group and the Coastal Health making sure, and the BC Centre for Disease Control making sure that naloxone has really gone out in a massive way, it's ironically the safest place to use your drugs is some filthy, feces-infested alley in the downtown east side. And the other thing that's striking about the deaths is that 80% of the people dying are men and only 20% are women. And we know there's less women using drugs than men overall, but it's not like that. It's more like 40% to 60 or 35 to 65. You know what I mean? I'm just saying these are the startling problems that the epidemiologists are looking at this epidemic. You know, they've declared it a public health emergency, and they're trying to reconcile. They're trying to effectively stop the deaths and move forward. The other thing is that there was an article the other day printed, and it just basically said that, oh, you know, these things take time. So the facilities that Vancouver Coastal Health has agreed to fund has sent away to the federal government to get an exemption from the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act that the city of Vancouver is holding up with permits, which is shocking to me because we should show up somewhere and sit in and just say, get them going. It's really, really exhausting to keep the pace up that we're faced with here. The city has not spent any money. They increased the taxes so that they could pay the more firemen. So more firemen are getting careers, in a sense, out of all these overdoses, because firemen don't go to fires anymore. They go to overdoses. And that's been so in most communities, that's true.
Because they're the first medical, like, emergency responders.
Yeah, first responder, yeah. Right? That's correct.
Now, in terms of the drug usage, like, has drug usage have been pretty constant or gradually going up before those drugs are laced with this fentanyl stuff?
Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, we get trends, and it's basically there's a number of factors, certainly what's being sold. So, you know, my surprise, I'm not an addict, and I just worked with people, and I'm a community organizer, and I'm, you know, that's what I do.
You just make sure that less people die from this stuff within the context.
Well,
my
approach to this is that you take the people most likely to die, and you get them together in rooms, and you say, you guys are, what are you going to do about this? Like, what can you guys do? Because for the most part, the funding isn't ever going to go to the users, and that's been true. All this money's rolled down, all of these tax increases and this and that and announcements, none of it's going to the drug users. The drug users at this point in Vancouver, despite this huge public health emergency, they still haven't got a place to go to the bathroom. So they can get needles all they want, they can go shoot dope in an injection site, but they can't find a toilet. So it's really creepy. Like, they can't go in somewhere and just sit down and get warm, and that you're at a, you know, like that kind of really soft funding, which is because they're all cut off welfare. So one of the problems, so there's the drug trade, and suddenly the place is just floating in cocaine because cocaine's coming in. Well, I can't predict that, neither can you. It just happens. And then my surprise was, oh, well, the cocaine users will use the cocaine, the heroin users will use the heroin. You don't have that here. People seek oblivion, and they just add different drugs to their menu of drugs, as I call it. You know, we saw people, there was lots and lots of heroin in the 90s, and then cocaine came in, and it started coming in, and really a lot of powdered cocaine, and it was real cocaine. There was cocaine in it. You know, it was fairly decent in terms of what people seek out for buying drugs on the legal market, that it actually had cocaine in it. And then we saw rock get marketed, and it was ready rock. It was already rocked up. Before that, people had to make their own rock. So you see these trends, and no one will talk about it very much because it's illegal. Those are the kind of things that it's really smart, if you're trying to prevent deaths, to have the people using the drugs talk about how they can use them more safely. Or, you know, all the other issues, of course, which is, could you go to recovery if you wanted to? Is there a treatment for stimulants? Because right now the favorite thing, we interviewed 50 people a few weeks back, and my surprise was when I'd say, well, did you come here today to use up or down? We'll say that. And they'll say down. And then I said, did you use up? And they'll say yes. And then what they said they're doing is they're combining fentanyl with crystal meth, because the word on the street is that if you do crystal meth at the same time as you're doing fentanyl, your heart will keep pounding through any kind of overdose, so you won't die or you won't overdose. And I said, well, that's like a speedball. These were very popular to do this powdered cocaine with powdered heroin in the 90s, right? And we had these high rates of overdose. Anyway, I just know this because what you want to do is talk about it and say, you know, don't share needles. If you're going to do these drugs, how do you do them? Do you know how to revive an overdose? Is everyone trained in CPR? This is the kind of work that the drug user group does. You do a lot of education, advocacy, and support. And so I, that theme is kept going with the work that we're doing now. But the combination of cocaine and heroin in those days was called a speedball, and this combination of fentanyl and crystal meth is called a goofball, I was informed when I was doing those interviews. So it's ever changing, and if we do an interview next month, they might be different again. You just don't know what you're dealing with.
Right. So it, like in the beginning, those drugs are really high quality stuff, and then later on, when the drug dealers want to make more money out of the volume, they mix it up with like random stuff, right?
Well, labemazole got put into, we went into a phase where there was just tremendous amounts of crack cocaine being smoked in our neighborhood. And then it was making people sick because it had pig dewormer that's called labemazole. And as far as anyone could tell, this labemazole was being put in the cocaine in South America or Mexico or somewhere en route. It wasn't happening here. Anyway, I'm just saying, you get these trends, and then you can go to a BC Center for Disease Control website, and they try to stay on top of it because they get people coming in to emerge with these odd, you know, sort of an epidemic of some weird symptoms, and then they become curious, and then they started testing the labemazole, warning people about it and what the symptoms would be. It doesn't have, it's some people don't react badly to labemazole, and other people do. Anyway, I'm just saying, it's a constant, like, it's never died down. In terms of health problems and death rates, if they're not dying of overdose, then it's endocarditis or, you know. And the worst problem we've seen is that welfare is cutting people off. And I think it causes a psychological kind of hopelessness for people, because it's one thing to be hunting for a place to live, but welfare is going to cover you once you find one. Now welfare is cutting you off, so even if you find a place to live, you're not going to have your rent covered. So the worst kind of really alley dwellers, you know, people that are really using drugs in a reckless manner, and they're in terrible health, and they're constantly overdosing and going to the hospital. Many of them they get arrested and released to this community, but they're on red zones and community conditions, they're called, and they fail to comply with them, and they're rearrested, charged with three more crimes, and put back in jail, and yet they've really done nothing except miss an appointment. So that kind of, if that's happened to you three or four times, or you've been involved in that for 6 years or 8 years, people have lost all sense of themselves, all sense of a future. And the people who really do employ those people are the dealers. They may need people to enforce, go collect debts for them, or you know what I mean, and they can just pay them in drugs. They're the cheapest employees you can imagine. You know, you just give them some extra drugs and they'll sell drugs for you. You know what I mean? It's like, so it's a real mess, and that's why we push so hard for these substitution programs. The problem with the substitution programs, we've had them for many years. It was methadone alone, and finally we fought to get Suboxone, but they're both taken orally. And one of the things, if someone's injecting a lot, is to offer them an injection drug that's prescribed to them. And this is why the heroin program is often very important here, that it's pure heroin, it's what they wanted. They don't, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen the results. The results are very, very good. And most of the heroin-assisted therapy throughout the world shows very promising results, both to have people become abstinent and also to have people, if they're not going to become abstinent, become quite healthy, become employed, reunite with their families, and start to live a very regular life, because no one can even tell they're on these drugs.
Right. You've given me a lot of like different avenues to talk about with respect to this. Let's see. You talk about welfare cutting people off. Are they from provincial budget cuts, or are they from just the fact that these
it's
people
policy.
Are getting locked up?
It's policy. So they've changed the Welfare Act since the late 90s, and they've done it very slowly. This is the creep. And I talked to people who were injecting in the tent outdoors, and I said, you're not on welfare? I said, why aren't you on welfare? And he said, I have to prove that someone in my immediate family had earned $7,000 for two of the last 5 years. Well, that's a really complicated thing. I certainly couldn't do that. I don't know what your situation is, but I could not show that someone in my immediate family had, and show up with these employment records and check stubs and prove that. And so you can't think of a worse policy. Let's take people that are probably going to commit crimes if they don't have any money. And BC welfare policy is now just leave them. Don't give them anything. And you know what else is not covered? Is their health care is not covered. They don't have MST coverage. So they have no control over their health care. We have what in this neighborhood is called a mobile medical unit that was invented for the Olympics because they wanted to be able to have an emergency room up at Whistler or something. Anyway, it's just a lovely facility, $10,000 a day. It's sitting in an empty lot down here. And it's a great thing because now when people overdose quite locally here, they're taken to a local place to say to them, you know, here, lie down. Are you know what I mean? They can give them that emergency care that they used to go across town to St. Paul's Hospital and then get released to the street to come back. So it's better to have them local. The problem is that, and right there, all those doctors have been trained and social workers, I think there's social workers there, that to immediately say, you know, Ann, you just had a severe overdose. Have you considered going on methadone or Suboxone? And then I might say, sure, I'll try it. This is freaking me out. I'm going to die. And then they write me a script, say, take this to a pharmacy. So I take it to a pharmacy and they say, you're not covered under MSP. And they try and charge you, you know, it's cheaper to do street drugs than to pay for those prescriptions. So even the physicians aren't really aware of this, that if your welfare is not covering you, then you have to pay your MSP premiums and they don't have any money anyway. They live in an alley. So that's a huge problem. The public just doesn't seem to be aware of it. BC is the only province, I think, that does these weird monthly payments for a program that the payments don't cover it at all. In fact, but, you know, it's being done, and it has been for a long time here. The old MSP system, it's now run by a private corporation called Maximus from the U.S., and they've had a $4.2 billion contract now for a number of years, and no one in the public seems to be aware of this, but this is a sort of slow creep to just deny people health care. If they do get health care by ambulance, their bills are kept for them. So say you're 23 and you've been picked up by an ambulance a bunch of times and taken to Emerge and you weren't covered by welfare during those pickups, they will keep that bill for you, and then when you get your life together and go get your driver's license, they'll tell you how much money you owe St. Paul's Hospital. And this is extremely discouraging and wrong. It's just wrong to do that to people. Because I don't know, you know, again, why wouldn't they relapse and go back to the streets? What's happening, if you read any of the reports on homelessness, and say you take a report and you think, oh, I'm not reading this whole thing, just search up drug use or addiction, and then you'll find that little section. Because in all of the homeless reports, they talk about the relationship between addiction and homelessness, and no one's really sure, because many homeless people don't ever use drugs until they're homeless. And their addiction was based on trying to medicate their way through such terrible, bleak hopelessness, where other people would say the reason someone's homeless is because their behavior is so bad because they're an addict, that they keep stealing or incidents keep occurring and they get kicked out of their housing and they become homeless. But they'll often say this now in these reports, that the relationship between addiction and homeless is not well understood, and that homelessness really adds to addiction or even causes addiction.
Like, no one really knows whether homelessness is the chicken or the egg to the addiction problem, right?
That's right. You look at those, and I always read them and look for that stuff, because the police often make these reports. You can go and, if you like watching paint dry, read every police report from the last 10 years, and you'll see over and over again, they talk about chronic offenders. So you'll be reading along about these people who are career criminals, and they use all these terms for them, and then you just wait and wait and wait and wait. Oh, they're addicts. Isn't that interesting? Are they really career criminals? Or are they like put in the position where they can't get the drug they're addicted to and they have to commit crime? I mean, who knows?
Or could they be so desperate that they don't have any other option except to collect debt or do some crimes for the drug dealers? Mm-hmm. Right?
Well, in the olden days, I'm 62. This never went on in this neighborhood, and I watched it closely. I've been here for a long time, I guess 23 years. And when people were released from prison, they had welfare. And even if it was remand prison, because there's prison, there's federal prison, provincial prison, and then remand. Remand means that you're awaiting trial. So you haven't been found guilty yet, but you keep not showing up at court, so they just decide they're going to jail you while you wait to see the judge. And then the judge gives you the time you've already served waiting to see the judge as you're sentenced. I don't know if you know this. This is massive. There's been like a 400% increase in the last 10 years in the number of people who are in the remand system. And it's just been the same number for many years, a stable number of people who are what they call sentenced. In other words, you've seen the judge, he gives you your jail time, and then you go to jail. What we've got now is people in jail waiting to sue a judge. I mean, double, triple, four times the number of people that are in jail. Most of them, by far, most of them are awaiting trial. And that means they're poor. That would never happen to me. Someone would come and get me out of jail. I wouldn't be sitting there waiting to see a judge. You know what I mean? You get bailed out. But if you don't have those, you know, so who is it then? It's Aboriginal people who don't have family support because their families are dead or in jail themselves, or you know what I mean? And then also very impoverished people. And it's very racialized for sure. It's discrimination. I mean, the police arrest far more people that are of color and they're more suspicious, you know. Anyway, I'm just saying, there's some excellent programs that Vancouver has not adopted, and it's very frustrating. Seattle adopted a program because the public defenders in Seattle are all organized into one group, and they started to take the police to court and say, you are arresting a disproportionate number of black people, and we are going to sue you over this. And after the fifth time or something, the police were finally dragged kicking and screaming to do a diversion project. So they have a diversion project in certain sections. It's a physical thing. About 200 people in Seattle, whenever they're picked up, they're not charged. They're taken to a place to get support for their drug use. And if they walk out, that's fine. The next time the police pick them up, they take them back. And then, you know, around and around. But at least they don't keep getting put into remand and then released with no welfare. So it's more of a, everyone says, if you look, it's sort of official that addiction is an illness and it should be treated in a healthcare system. It's not true. I mean, they say that and say that and say that, but there's never been this many addicted people in jail ever in the history of Canada. Massive numbers of people are in jail than we've ever had before. So, and it's not talked about because the kind of people that go to jail have no voice and no one ever brings them anywhere and gets them to talk about this stuff.
But this is happening to the point where it's becoming a public health issue, even for, let's say, wealthy, let's say, like young people living in the suburbs.
That's right.
Who experiment with these stuff and overdose and die, and nobody really knows mm-hmm. about it until they're dead, right?
That's correct. There's a perfect, what I call the perfect storm of these really high numbers. It's not just the kind of thing that's going on in my neighborhood, or the numbers wouldn't be as high. We've had a number of disastrous things happen. The overprescription of opiates is well known. A survey of Vandu members 5 years ago, we found out that more than a third of the people who were members of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users had initially had a car pedestrian, some sort of vehicle injury,
like an accident
or
injury.
A workplace injury. And they started off on pain meds, and one day their doctor cut them off, so they went to the black market and they became addicts that are very much involved in the whole illicit drug scene, you know. And then but there's other people who you know, if you were a waitress in Abbotsford and you know were titillated by, I don't know, hanging out with Hell's Angels, or I don't know, this whole scene had developed amongst, I don't know if they're millennials or a little bit older than that, they were snorting pills. You would grind up oxys or something, and that was sort of a recreational thing. And what happened was that they had a huge clampdown. They told the doctors they had to stop prescribing these large numbers of oxys and green beanies. I don't know. I only know the street names of them, but they are prescribed drugs. And they used to be available on the corner. You could just go buy them. And now you can't buy them. And when you go to buy something now, it's fentanyl. So we're getting people that aren't addicts. They don't use drugs every day. And they just use them from time to time. But they go and buy these, fake oxys, and they don't know it's a fake oxy. They take it and die.